Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is Texas a southern state or a western state? Could it be both or neither or something else entirely? For nearly two centuries, we Texans have taken pains to memorialize our finest moments while minimizing the things we are not so proud of, which has injected more than a little mythology into popular perceptions of Texas history. And then what we value tends to change over time as well, so that while some generations and regions of the state treasured their allegiance to the Confederacy, others built their self-image around a more Western lifestyle or cultural ties to Mexico. All this has made Texas a particular challenge to characterize, even in the 21st century, and my guest today was interested in exploring the reasons. Glenn Sample Ely is a writer, historian, and documentary filmmaker. His new book is called Where the West Begins, Debating Texas Identity. He'll be signing copies of that book this Sunday, June 5th, at the Barnes & Noble store at Lincoln Park on Northwest Highway in Dallas. He's also got some upcoming signings in Fort Worth, and you can find out about those on the Think page of KERA.org. Glenn, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So what makes this question of Texas as either southern state or western state such a daunting one for historians?
It's been going on for almost a century now. And really, you have certain camps with southern historians may want to put out their point of view. Western historians may want to advance their point of view. So the debate's been going back and forth, and I wanted to resolve that once and for all, really put some evidence out there to say exactly what we are and what we're not.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also the question of our history as opposed to the New South and the New West, because those are different categories once again.
Right. We have the Old South, the Old West, and then there's the new schools of, you could say, the Texas Southern School now or the New West School that's coming out of the West. Basically, this book is one of the first attempts to put a new West interpretation upon our Western history. In other words, the Western part of our state.
Is it even possible to take a state as big as Texas, which definitely has geographic regions, and say it is all one thing or another thing?
No, and you can't do it. That's why that's what I point out in my book. Texas is southern, it's western, and it's a lot more. And I think it's that incredible diversity that gives us really so much to brag about. We have an incredibly rich history, so many rich cultures, very diverse, rich environment. Let's celebrate that rather than trying to fit Texas into one limiting interpretation, which is impossible.
So you have in the very beginning of the book a photograph of the side of a Fort Worth police car on which is written the words Fort Worth Gateway is Gateway to the West?
Where the West begins.
Where the West begins, excuse me. But you don't actually think it's Fort Worth specifically.
No, and that was one of the things is if the West begins in Texas, how can we prove it? And so I used three criteria or barometers to look at that and was able, I think, to pretty well prove the case. The first one being environment, the second one being cultural identity, and then the third one being race relations. And if you use each of those three, you can really see where the West begins. And Fort Worth, I have this map in the book, which there's a shatter belt region between East Texas and West Texas, which is really the central Texas area. It's about a 200-mile stretch. And in that shatter belt area is where the South and the West collide, and you have this commingling or intermingling of cultural and environmental factors so that it's a mixed identity.
Mm-hmm. So anyone who is from Texas can tell you that there's East Texas and there's West Texas, and there are a lot of differences. But one of the things you mentioned, environmental factors, simply rainfall is a huge delineator for you.
Yeah, and that comes from John Wesley Powell. He did Congress had him do a report, and in 1878, he came up with this 20-inch rainfall break line. And he, historians, New West historians since then, have used this 20-inch rainfall break line as a factor of where the West is in Texas, because if you have less than 20 inches of rain per year, you've got to have irrigated agriculture, and you have to use, you have to pump water from underneath the ground to water your crops. Otherwise, you're going to have a Dust Bowl situation like we did in the 30s. So that 20-inch rainfall break line, a show where that really takes place in Texas, and it's right around San Angelo, west of Sweetwater, then going up to Lubbock and Amarillo. And Fort Worth gets 34 to 35 inches of rain per year, so it's nowhere near that break line. It lies actually about 200 miles east of that 20-inch rainfall break line.
Another notable difference is that the western part of the state had very few people kept in slavery before the Civil War.
Right, and they had very few white Southerners, actually, mm-hmm. before the Civil War, which was interesting. No one had ever really looked at it. But historic West Texas is the three counties lying west of the Pecos River. That would be El Paso, Presidio, and then Pecos County, which came out of Presidio. And those were really the original three counties in West Texas. And if you look at the demographics in the 1860 census, you know, El Paso County has less than 2% Southerners, white Southerners. Presidio County, about 5%. Places like Maverick County, Eagle Pass, they have, you know, less than 4% Southerners. And then in all of West Texas, west of the 100th Meridian in 1860, you have only 21 slaves. That's out of a population of about 5 to 6,000 people. So it's a minuscule. It's 0.4%.
So part of the reason for that is people who would have wanted to have slaves were concerned that if they were there on the border, their slaves would easily escape to freedom.
Right. It's not far over the Rio Grande. And the white Southerners were also concerned that Tejanos in West Texas, who weren't especially sympathetic to the Southern identity and cotton slave culture, would aid and abet these slaves going over the river. So there was always this concern. That's why you don't see many black cowboys before the Civil War out in West Texas, because if you put them on a horse near the Rio Grande, it's going to, you know, raise the potential of escape. So that was a big factor, is that you don't have – because before the Civil War – there wasn't the irrigation technology to irrigate crops. That didn't come in until after World War I. So take, for instance, El Paso with less than 10 inches of rain per year. It's going to be pretty hard to grow cotton in El Paso area unless you're down along the river. But a lot of the county, you couldn't do that. And it just wasn't conducive to a slave cotton culture in that time period before the Civil War.
I was really interested to read that, you know, it makes some sense that Tejanos, who also experienced racism at the hands of white Southerners who did move in, would reject that slaveholding culture. But also German immigrants in the central part of the state really wanted nothing to do with that.
Right. And that caused a lot of friction in the Western Hill Country around Fredericksburg, Comfort. There were slaveholding Germans in Comal County and more towards central Texas. But as you move west in this Shatterbelt area, which is where Fredericksburg and Comfort are, you start to get this mixed identity. And you had a lot of antagonism between these Germans who came into the area and were using free labor. They did not own slaves. They were yeoman farmers. And they brought, shall we say, different agricultural practices to Texas that some of the southern planters didn't understand or appreciate. And there's some evidence that the free labor Germans were producing more cotton per acre and also cleaner cotton, which was commanding a higher price at the market. And that created some resentment, obviously, with the southern planters. And so there was this xenophobia of these Germans with their, you know, strange agricultural practices. And the southern planters really didn't take time to understand the German perspective or the German point of view, and just were not very sympathetic to what the free labor system was producing.
So explain this, though. In 1860, when people in Texas were voting, I should say men in Texas were voting whether to secede from the Union or not, El Paso County voted for secession. What accounts for that?
what accounts for that? It was a rigged vote. They have a time
long history of that.
That's right. They do. It's a time-honored practice of importing Mexicans across the Rio Grande, giving them some liquor and some money, and then holding them in a hall until it's time to vote, and then taking them back across the river after they voted. So there's a number of newspaper accounts that I cite, as well as primary accounts of people traveling through the region during the 1860 vote, which shows that it likely was fraudulent. If you look at the demographics of the region, there's only 2%, as I say, 2% white Southerners. The Tejanos there, over 90% of the people there were Mexican Americans. What I found in my research is that no Mexican Americans west of the 100th Meridian in 1860 owned any slaves. So why was there this vote for secession? Well, you had a couple, what I call the secession ring, a couple of powerful, wealthy Anglos like James McGoffin, Simeon Hart, who were the two wealthiest men in the county. And controlled a lot of the jobs available to Mexican Americans, and they controlled the political system and the machinery, and they really did operate the political levers ruthlessly. It was not a democratic society. They called the shots all the way.
So there was already, right before the Civil War, a pretty active military culture in parts of West Texas. What role did that play, and how did things change when suddenly you had the Union Army and the Confederate Army?
Yeah, and I was going to say a big factor in identity in 1860 is the federal frontier economy. And the Germans living in the Western Hill Country and a lot of the people living in far West Texas are very dependent upon that federal economy, as many people are today with federal jobs. So these forts that are in the regions, not only do they provide protection for the settlers in the region, but then they're also a huge economic boon. You and I might put in bids for contracts for corn or hay or beef, and that brings a lot of money into our pockets. So we're not going to want to change the status quo and leave the Union when we're making good money and a good living on the frontier there, and plus the fact that those soldiers are defending our families. So it would be insane for us to want to secede from the Union. So a lot of these communities that vote against secession have federal forts in their region. So do you want me to go on into what happens when the federal troops leave? Or?
Well, let me jump in for just a second, because there were also West Texas cattlemen who did not find themselves to be above selling beef cattle to Union troops.
Right. Yes. During the Civil War, you have by October 1864, the Confederate dollar is worth 2 cents. There's also this requirement that you must take Confederate money and you must use Confederate money in all business dealings. So you're taking a beating every time you get engaged in any sort of commerce. So naturally, people try and evade this. And a big factor here is that you have Confederate beef contractors like John Chisholm, who are originally selling beef to the Confederacy. During the war, they shift that and they start selling to the Union Army.
My guest is Glenn Sample Ely. He's a historian, writer, and documentary filmmaker. His new book is called Where the West Begins, Debating Texas Identity. He'll be in Dallas to sign copies of the book this Sunday, June 5th from 3 to 5 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. He's got upcoming signings as well in Fort Worth that you can find out about on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, now's the time to call in. You can get to us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, historian, and documentary filmmaker Glenn Sample Ely. His new book is called Where the West Begins, Debating Texas Identity. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Glenn, what else of importance was taking place in the western part of the state during the Civil War?
Well, I was just going to finish the point about the cattle trade. So with the Confederate money being essentially worthless, and you had to sell to the Confederacy for their money. In other words, I'm a cattle dealer and you're requiring me to accept Confederate money for my cattle. I'm going to begin looking for other markets. And that's what John Chisholm and other ranchers did who were living along the Concho River area where it joins the Colorado River near Santa Ana, Texas, is where the Chisholm Ranch was. So Chisholm moves out there in the fall of 1863, and he's looking for new markets, and that one of his prime customers is going to be the Union Army at Fort Sumner, New Mexico, on the Pecos River, because they're paying in hard currency, mm-hmm. gold and silver. So Chisholm starts... He starts a business arrangement with Bill Franks and James Patterson at Fort Sumner and begins in 1864 moving Texas cattle up to the Union Army in New Mexico and selling to the Union Army. Charles Goodnight always claimed that he was the first person to open that trade with Fort Sumner in 1866 in the famous Goodnight Loving Trail. But that's one of these myths that isn't true. John Chisholm and these other West Texas ranchers in 1864 and 1865 pioneered this trail, not Goodnight.
And it wasn't until the 1890s that large numbers of white Southerners started to move into West Texas?
Yeah, actually in about 1881, and mm-hmm. that's with the railroad. So when the railroad gets to West Texas, then you have this significant population shift. But up until 1890, you had a sharing of power with Tejanos and whites, and you had intermarriage also. But then by 1890, the numbers change, and the Anglos get a majority in terms of numbers, and then they also have the economic clout. And so they begin relegating their former allies. They really betray their former allies who they settled the frontier with, they shared elected offices with, they married into those families. And yet after 1890, they essentially relegate them to second-class status and begin segregating them.
So did those Texans really look to the history of the Revolution and our independence from Mexico as a defining feature of who they were?
The white Texans yeah. moving out there. Well, this is really a phenomenon across the U.S. This isn't just, as I point out in here, racism isn't just a Southern or a Texan problem. It's been going on in our country since it was founded. Mm-hmm. And we did this with the Native Americans. We did this with the Mexican Americans. It's all of the groups. When Anglos were able to dominate them with their numbers, they did. But there's this interesting phenomenon that what happens in that time period before they can dominate. So like in West Texas, El Paso, Presidio County, in that time period from 1850 to 1890, Richard White talks about this middle ground period where you don't have enough power to take control, seize control. So you have to reach an accommodation with these other groups. You may not want to, but you have to. And so to me, that was a fascinating period in West Texas where you had Anglos and Tejanos sharing offices, intermarrying, helping to defend the frontier together. That was really a good period of accommodation as compared to what happened after 1890.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First on the line, we have J.D. in
Hello.
Dallas. Hi, J.D.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll make a short comment, then I do have a real question. My people were known as pioneers of Texas, and my immediate family, all of them were working with cattle and working on ranches, and I was born on a ranch near here. Now, some of that started phasing out. Some of them actually went into rodeo and rodeo shows, and I had a cousin who had a rodeo at Mansfield for 40 years, and he managed it, part owner. His son, 11 years old, went to New York and performed as the real Texas cowboy and beat the grown men in roping cows.
Mm-hmm.
But back to Texas. And as the ranches were phasing out, it looks like to me, and I'd like to ask the fellow here, tell me, now, when they were phasing out, we had a lot of cotton coming in. There was a cotton exchange established in Dallas. If it wasn't for that, Dallas would not even be nowhere near as powerful or big as it is now. It is the foundation of Dallas the way it is today. Now, Fort Worth, it's a different story. It was cattle. And, like, it all phased out. And right now, there's, I don't know of any relatives, maybe immediately, they're even working in ranches.
Well, let me jump in, J.D. I appreciate your points. It takes us a little bit off topic from the book, but certainly cattle and cotton, both very important industries throughout most of the history of the state.
Right. And in West Texas, you do have both cotton and cattle after 1890. And I really think that Fort Worth and Dallas have a mixed identity. They're both Southern and Western. I don't think you can draw a clear marker saying that Fort Worth is completely Western just because they had the stockyards or cattle drives, because you had cattle drives up to the Midwest, you had cattle drives to Louisiana. So just the fact that you're driving cattle somewhere doesn't mean that you're Western. That was something that happened all across America. I think what happens is you've got to look at not just the industries that the people are engaged in, but also the environment and the culture of what's going on in an area, and also the race relations, to see if we're really in the West or if we're in the South. And I think, again, in Dallas-Fort Worth, we're in a mixed area.
To what extent were segregation laws codified in different parts of the state, and to what extent were they simply was it simply understood that you could only live in certain neighborhoods if you had a particular last name?
Right. This is one of the interesting things. West of the 100th Meridian, you had what's called de facto segregation, where it's more of an informal nature. It's very different than you do have laws. You do have some laws on the books which spell out relations between the races, what you know, blacks or Tejanos can or can't do. But it's just a few laws, as in comparison to East Texas or east of Interstate 35, where you do have a rigid, very detailed Jim Crow statutes about what blacks can and can't do. And that was something that was very interesting. In West Texas, there is segregation, but it's informal, much more of an informal nature. And in many communities, it's not spelled out on the books. And this was the thing, is to compare race in West Texas to other parts of the country and see what matches it. And what I found was that the segregation occurring in West Texas was very, very close to what was going on in Arizona and California, because you had the same sort of thing, this informal segregation out there. But you also had some segregation, especially in movie theaters, in pools, in cafes, hotels, things like that. So it wasn't just in West Texas that the segregation was occurring. It was occurring all across the Southwest. These states that border Mexico had very, very similar types of segregation to West Texas, west of the 100th Meridian.
So I spent a lot of years living in El Paso, and there is a widespread perception there that what takes place in the big cities, Dallas and Houston, and particularly Austin, doesn't necessarily relate directly back to what's going on there. And I was interested to read in the book that people have long sensed in West Texas that they were separate in some ways in terms of how they were considered by the rest of the state.
Yeah, and there's these editorials in the El Paso Times that I mentioned in the book where that region really does feel like they're getting the short end of the stick. They talk about being treated as a second-class colony. You have these university lands out there in West Texas, and you have minerals being extracted from them, and the money's going back to Austin and East Texas. And what's West Texas getting out of the deal? I mean, for many, many years, they didn't even have a university. And so they felt like they were forgotten about, that Austin didn't really care about them, that they were, again, this second-class colony. So there was this move in the early 20th century where to get a university out there. And there was talk of secession unless they did get a university because A&M was so far away in College Station and the climate was so different in West Texas and the environmental conditions that they needed a agriculture university out there that would be more suited to the region. And so that's what really took place.
Let's jump back to the phones now. This time we have Michael on the line in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. What an interesting subject. I've just noticed in my life, something I've commented on many times, you know, to my friends, when I travel in East Texas, especially deep East Texas, which my girlfriend calls behind the pine curtain, and but I find people, just the way they interact and the way they are to strangers, I'm always a stranger, they're more fearful, they're kind of very protective and just not that really welcoming. And I go to West Texas, and I think of El Paso as being kind of not really part of West Texas. It's like another thing. But West Texas, people like the landscape are, everything's out there. I mean, they walk up, they say who they are, they want to know who you are. They're very outgoing and open. And from what you're saying, I'm thinking this is maybe more than just a landscape, or maybe it's a whole history thing. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that. Thank you.
Interesting observation. Thanks for your call, Michael. What do you think, Glenn?
Well, that's one of the things I love about Texas is its cultural diversity. It's not just East Texas and West Texas, but South Texas is a whole nother kettle of fish. And then the Panhandle, it's really in a lot of ways like the Midwest. So that's what I love about Texas is that we really could be, you know, five different states if you look at the regions and the cultures and the environment. And that's, to me, what I'd really like to celebrate. I found a lot of wonderful people in East Texas, too. I spent 5 years there working as a reporter. And I think it's just people are people. And I love East Texas just as much as West Texas.
We have an email here from Mary in Dallas who writes, "What's wrong with Texas as a southwestern state? As someone from the Southwest, Texas feels more like New Mexico and Arizona than Louisiana or Wyoming. The Southwest incorporates Mexican and traditional Western lifestyles." What do you think about that?
Absolutely. And I would say west of the 100th Meridian, Texas is certainly southwestern. And the border plays a huge role in influencing what goes on in that region. But I have to say that Central Texas and East Texas, I just really couldn't categorize them as southwestern. East of Interstate 35 and east is really going to be more of a southern identity and southern culture. And west of the 100th Meridian, no doubt that's going to be southwestern.
You mentioned a few minutes ago El Paso talking about seceding if they didn't get a university and more respect from Austin. These days, occasionally, the term secession comes up again. And you think this palaver is simply that. It's just talk.
Well, I would ask people to think about what that word conjures up. That's probably the biggest tragedy in our nation's history. It's not a word to be thrown around lightly. 600,000 people died. Then you have the specter of slavery. After the Civil War, you have military occupation during Reconstruction and the humiliation Texas and other states felt during that. Then we get into Jim Crow, the Klan, segregation, lynchings, burnings. I mean, do we want to bring all that back again? I mean, it's a tragedy and a nightmare. And I think to throw that word around is just irresponsible.
Are you surprised that it's used so often?
Well,
not often, but it happens in the public square.
Yeah, I think really what you need to think about is it's this independent streak that Texas and other states feel. We need federal help, but yet we chafe at the federal regulations. And I understand that because a lot of states feel independent and they don't want to take directions from Uncle Sam. But the fact is that we need federal help. So that goes into the equation. We couldn't maintain our road system today, our incredible interstate and massive road system in Texas, without federal dollars. So TxDOT needs those federal subsidies. We need them in education. We need them in medicine across the board. So I think that that word is used politically, but I don't think it's a word that we want to throw around lightly. It's just a dangerous word today.
Well, that need for federal help and yet chafing against any kind of federal control brings us to another really elemental myth of Texas, and that is of the Texas Rangers, which sort of have gone down in history as the great protectors of the frontier, when in fact it was federal troops that did a lot of that work.
Right. Texas, both as a republic and as a state, lacked the resources necessary to defend its frontiers and its borders. During the Republic period, Mexico invaded us twice in 1842, and we couldn't do anything about it. They invaded San Antonio. We were essentially helpless. Then, with regards to the Indian raids, without the U.S. Army during the Civil War, the frontier rolled back to its position in 1849. There's this myth about the Rangers defending the frontier successfully, but that's inaccurate. I did detailed research in Chapter 2 of this book, which proves conclusively that the frontier did fall back to its position in 1849. Really, the subtext to this argument is that we don't need federal help. We can do it on our own. But it's also true with our debt. When we entered the Union, we had a massive debt of $12 million. You know, we didn't actually pay off our Revolution debt till 1902. The whole point behind the Compromise of 1850 was to get that money from the U.S. government to get rid of our debt.
My guest is historian, writer, and documentary filmmaker Glenn Sample Ely. His new book is called Where the West Begins, Debating Texas Identity. He's got some signings coming up in Fort Worth that are listed on the Think page of KERA.org. The one coming up soonest is this Sunday, June 5th, at the Barnes & Noble store at Lincoln Park in Dallas. That's from 3 to 5. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@KERA.org. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Historian Glenn Sample Ely is here. We're talking this hour about his new book, Where the West Begins, Debating Texas Identity. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Weatherford and speak with Debbie. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. First of all, I thoroughly enjoy this topic. I'm a PhD student at the University of North Texas, and my studies focus on slavery in the northwestern counties, from Parker County north to the Red River and west to the 100th Meridian. And I very much agree with your assessment that the West did not end at Fort Worth. What I have found is that slaves were approximately a third of the population, which basically agrees with Randolph B. Campbell's point of view in his book, Empire for Slavery. I also found out that most of the people that were in any kind of positions of authority, sheriffs, business owners, etc., were slave owners in these counties after they were settled. They were basically settled by slave owners. It appears that the Northwest didn't necessarily support the institution, partly because of their vote against secession, or for secession, excuse me. But mostly, I agree with Mr. Ely again on his observation that was mainly for protection. My question for you is, have you done a lot of studies, or does your book include studies on slave owners and places of origin, their leadership roles, et cetera, in your book?
No, I look at slavery west of the 100th Meridian and what's going on and how much of a factor it is with the people there. And the wealthiest man in El Paso County, Simeon Hart, was also the largest slaveholder. So he clearly has a very, very strong Southern identity. And he even offered to lend Jefferson Davis some money at the beginning of the Civil War at low interest rates, I might add, to help get the Confederacy underway. I did study the issue of slavery among these counties in the Shatterbelt region where identity is mixed. And you have these counties along the western frontier, again, out by Fredericksburg, Comfort, Mason, and then along the Red River in Gainesville and Jacksboro and some of these counties up there. Grayson County also voted against secession. And so there you have identity mixed. These counties actually do have slaveholders moving in during the later 1850s, and they essentially do take over control of some of these counties, but yet the counties still vote against secession. So there's a mixed identity in this area, with some counties being for and some against in regards to secession.
So we've learned in the past that much of the Deep South was plunged into really tough economic times when they lost this labor force that they had in the form of slavery. How did that change the balance between West and East Texas when you had, after the Civil War, the eastern parts of Texas having lost their population of enslaved laborers, and they just had never existed in the western part of the state?
Right. The Mexican Americans did most of the labor out in West Texas, so there wasn't a shortage of labor. Plus, after the Civil War, you have a huge influx of Mexicans coming in from northern Mexico. Mario Garcia mentions up to a million Mexicans coming to the U.S. During the 1880s and during the industrial period at the end of the 19th century. So there's not really a problem with the labor force. It was basically the whites always relied upon the Mexican Americans to do the labor.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Arlington, and we'll speak with Ed. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I'm enjoying the guest remarks. He's talking a lot about subjects I've thought a lot about myself, so I don't want to come off as too much of a crank. I agree with him that there's a strong part of Texas, a large part of Texas that's very much Southern, particularly East Texas and the pine forests and the cotton growing tradition.
Mm-hmm.
There's big parts of Texas that have more in common with the southwestern U.S. And then there's another part that has the western U.S. more in common with that. Nobody would say a state like Ohio is anything other than the Midwestern, or a state like Washington or Oregon or anything other than the Pacific Northwest, whereas Texas has all of these major influences in it. But I think one that you're missing is one you barely touched on a little while ago, and that is that anybody who's lived in North Texas for any length of time knows that they're in the Midwest. And if you've seen that painting, American Gothic, with the two old, prim, thin churchgoers standing in front of their home with a pitchfork, that's here, particularly the religious influence around here. The history, the agricultural history around here, with the agriculture that was done without much of the assistance of slaves.
Well, what do you think about that, Glenn? Do you see a lot of Midwest in the culture of Texas?
I do, especially in the Panhandle, because the census records reveal that large sections of the population moving in to the Panhandle and the South Plains after the Civil War were from the Midwest. So you have this Western element, because of the environment, creates limitations upon people living in the region. But a large part of their culture is definitely Midwestern. And certainly in North Texas, you have a lot of different elements coming together. It's a very mixed identity. I couldn't say that if we're talking about North Texas and that Red River country, I couldn't say that it was predominantly Midwest, but there's certainly Midwest influences, no doubt.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Doug in Dallas. Hey, Doug.
Hi. Hello, Mr. Neely, and hello, Chris.
Hello.
There was another force that was very active during this time period, the 1800s up to and after the Civil War, that put a real cramp in the Anglos and Tejano style, and that was the Comanches. What influence did they have as far as enhancing or slowing down the progression westward of the settlers? And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
That was actually one of the factors I used in showing identity in Texas, too, is this tribal frontier in this upper cross timbers or western cross timbers section of North Texas, you know, all the way to into Decatur westward. You really have a difference in the Indians. On the western side of this tribal frontier, you have the Comanches, you have the Kiowas, and you have the Apaches. On the eastern side, you have more of the woodland tribes with the Wichitas and the Caddos. So it was very interesting to see this, too, that Native American identity at this breaking point here. Certainly, the U.S. Army lacked enough soldiers. They repeatedly say in their reports during this time period that they don't have enough men or material to effectively check the Indians. For a long time, it's essentially a stalemate. With neither side having a significant upper hand. The frontier forts and the civilian communities stay put. The Indians don't overrun them, but at the same time, there's not enough troops to effectively deter Indian raiding, and so it's sort of a stalemate until you get into the 1870s.
How much progress have we made in updating public school curricula so that Texas history is accurate as opposed to myth after myth after myth?
I think that we've made progress, certainly, but I think we have a long way to go. My point about a lot of these myths or legends is that they're some of them are stuck in the past. They're limiting. They don't really reflect who we are today, and they don't represent all of our population. A lot of them are about white men. They don't include women. They don't include minorities. I don't think that a lot of these They're nice stories, and they're a lot of fun, and they're entertaining, but they don't serve us well in the 21st century in terms of being realistic, representing our diversity today, and helping us meet the challenges of the 21st century in Texas. I think the curriculum has come a long way, but there's still a culture war that's going on over our social studies curriculum, as we saw last year. And I think that that is far from settled. As you see the demographics change in Texas, within the next decade, you're going to see this rise up again. And I think you're going to have a different outcome 10 years from now in terms of the way our curriculum is written. Minorities will get a stronger voice in the curriculum, and they will be able to push through a lot of these changes that they wanted to make last year but were essentially voted down.
Are we the ones who have reinforced these enduring myths about who we are and where we came from? Or are some of those sort of externally placed on us by people from outside Texas who think they know what this place is?
I would say both. Absolutely. There's a lot of these that are romantic, pleasant, entertaining myths and legends that are a lot of fun, and they're great stories. And I think that we have a long tradition of relating these traditions. And I think you also have to look at the influence of Western movies and Western art upon our identity. A lot of what people think about Texas has come from these Western movies and Western art. Again, I don't think that that does us a great service in terms of being very accurate or representative of who we are. And I just don't think that Texans loved, like a lot of Americans, to cherry pick their history so that they can package their identity. I can take a little here, I can take a little there, and put those together, and this is who I am, and this is who I identify with. But I'm leaving out some parts of the history, maybe some parts that are more unpleasant that I don't want to deal with, some parts that I may not agree with, but to really have an accurate identity in terms of a Texan identity, we need to embrace all of who we are, all of our history, and all of the people who are participating in making that history. So that, again, means women, and that, again, means minorities, because for many, many years, they were kept out of that story.
What do you think the history of our definition of ourselves says about where we're going?
I think we still need to catch up. A lot of our identity is maybe in the 20th century or the 19th century, and we're in the 21st century, and we need to catch up. We're in a much more diverse world today, much more influenced by world events and other nations and a global economy, and we need to become a part of that. We need to get with the times. Hopefully there will be a way to keep our identity and the things that make Texas so special, all of our diverse cultures, the wonderful diversity and environment and people, let's keep that, but let's also move into the 21st century, because we have a lot of pressing problems, as we see right now, that we need to deal with, and I don't think these old identities are helping us with that.
You alluded earlier to the fact that you started your career in news, and I'm wondering what you think about Philip Graham's famous contention that news is the first rough draft of history.
I really have to pass on that. I haven't thought about that at all. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, talk about this. What's dangerous about hanging on to the myths and not confronting the things that we're not so proud of?
Well, let's take, for instance, West Texas. And I have a chapter here, chapter 4, which is really environmental history. There's this myth of the cowboy and West Texas being the cowboy's paradise. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of the ranchers in the 19th and early 20th centuries had an abusive relationship with the environment. They overstocked the land. They overgrazed it. They implemented fire suppression practices. And they created a lot of the problems. So we have in West Texas at least 50% of the land severely damaged with severe brush infestation, which helped exacerbate those wildfires we just had. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is directly related to overgrazing and overstocking of the lands. So I think that this myth of the cowboy, yes, the cowboy is wonderful. I love Westerns as much as the next person, but I think that we need to adopt prudent range management practices in West Texas and be really careful about how we engage the land out there, because it's fragile. It takes a lot longer for the land to heal, and sometimes it doesn't heal at all. Then there's the whole issue of farming, the myth that we can – this is very popular in the late 19th century and 20th century – that we can take the desert and make it bloom like a rose through irrigated agriculture.
Glenn Sample Ely is a writer, historian, and documentary filmmaker. His new book is called Where the West Begins, Debating Texas Identity. You can find information about his upcoming book signings on the Think page of KERA.org. Glenn, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.